Welcome back, everyone, to R2 Cast number 142. Our last episode being the second in a long list of Nuffield scholars for 2024. And David Tavenor and I found myself almost asking him for a job because I was very interested in the whole idea of insects as a livestock feed. And David is certainly pioneering in that field. Our next episode, number 153, will be with Hugh Evans, who is in charge of Three Pools Permaculture Farm. Don't ask me what it's about. I haven't filmed yet, and I'm sure I'll be very confused when I speak to him. I meant to say in the episode with David, but I forgot because I didn't hit record the first time. So I'll say it this time. On the All In series, obviously number 150 went really well with Rose Davis, an Olympian. But we're now bringing on, for those that are football fans, of which I certainly am one, a European Cup winner. So, like what's now known as Champions League, we're bringing someone on that's won that. And for those that really like football, will know in the sort of 80s and late 70s, Liverpool were, how do I put this, just one of the best teams that world football's ever seen. And the man that's coming on was part of that team. So quite exciting. All In series is fairly ramping up, and I'm really, really enjoying the food and farming side at the minute, especially because I get to interview Nuffield scholars, and not just interview Nuffield scholars thinking, oh my God, these people are amazing because they're Nuffield scholars. But then I feel bad saying that because I now am one, and it's quite exciting to sort of be part of such an elite crew. And I'm sure today's guest, because we've just been talking about it off podcast, off record, will say, it's still a bit surreal. We only really found out in the last 3 weeks that we were successful. And we still haven't been awarded at the point of recording. And I think if I've got the date of release right, we will be getting awarded it in the next 3 days. So all quite exciting. But today's guest today is Jock Gibson. Jock, would you like to say hello?
Hello.
Just before we get started with another episode of the R2 Cast, I would like to thank our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, formerly known as A-Plan Rural. Howden are heavily involved in the social media scene in the ag space with over 100,000 followers on Instagram. They use this following to host social media takeovers with farmers throughout the country to showcase their stories, as well as posting to their rural community blog with further articles about these people in the sector. On top of this, they like to support initiatives that are championing the British agricultural industry, such as myself. So thank you to Howden Rural for that. Looking forward to this. Good chat.
Yeah, very much so. Looking forward to it.
Good man, good. A couple of the Scottish contingent from Nuffield. I haven't actually got in touch with. I've got a feeling Hattie might be from Scotland, but I haven't actually spoke to Hattie. I haven't got in touch with her yet, but from her Instagram, it seems that way. And Hattie, if you're listening and that's wrong, I strongly apologise. But you certainly couldn't have two more Scottish folk than today. Yous won't be seeing this because I only released the audio. But I am sitting here with an iron brew, and Jock is sitting there with a tartan mug. So we couldn't look much more Scottish at this point as he lifts up the mug there. But Jock, for those listening, and for myself, really, we haven't spoken too much. I think I spoke to you once before. Tell us a bit about yourself. Give us a bit of background about you. But forgetting Nuffield, just in general, who is Jock Gibson?
Blimey. I guess a farmer and a butcher primarily. We farm here at Eden Vale, just outside a small village called Dallas, which is in Moray, up in the north of Scotland here. And then we've got a butcher shop, Macbeth's, in Forres. I've been running the butchery side of life since 2007, and my wife and I came up to the farm in 2015. Before that, I was a failed business building services engineer. Tried to have a professional career away from food and farming, and I wasn't particularly very good at it. Pulled the pin on that, and there was an opportunity to come home. So I managed to take that, and that's where we are today.
It's always quite interesting to see that. I mean, you're speaking to someone at the minute that might that is basically from a farm and went away and whatever. And I speak to a lot of folk on this, obviously, and it's quite often the case. You know, someone wants to go try something else, and then that opportunity comes up. Was that an opportunity you were looking for, Jock, to get back into farm, or was that just it happened and you were like, let's give it a shot?
So, coming back to the farm was never really an opportunity. That was something that was never going to present itself. Dad was a first generation farmer. And as far as mum and dad were concerned, this business was started and could finish with them. There was no, they didn't feel an obligation to pass it on to the next generation, and we didn't feel an obligation to take it on. And to a certain extent, the very opposite. We were probably actively discouraged. So it was always the plan that I was going to go away and do something else and do my own thing. It just so happened that I probably didn't know what I wanted to do. I spent a lot of time bumming around on boats and doing that sort of thing, and that was an easier career choice than actually working hard for a living. So my actual career choice, whilst it was good, I enjoyed it. I didn't really have the aptitude for it. I didn't have the attention to detail at that stage in my life, to care enough about it.
So what did that job involve? I mean, you said you failed. I'm sure that's not the case, but yeah, what did that actually involve?
So in its simplest form, I was designing heating and ventilation systems for buildings. So colleges, hospitals, university buildings, that sort of thing. Latterly, I was in Glasgow. Prior to that, I was in Peterborough. And when we were there, we were doing, extract systems for Ford Motor Company, for example. And so it's the sort of thing that nobody looks at, nobody really takes notice of it until it doesn't work, and then it upsets everybody. And the problem with I had was that, I'd be designing heating systems, and I would specify a gate valve, and apparently it should have been a globe valve, and to me it shut off water, and I didn't care. And it was at that point I realized I didn't care, that I probably realized I shouldn't be doing
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
it.
Do you know, I hope you didn't work on my college campus's heating, because it has two settings. One is 190 degrees heat in summer and not working in winter. That's the two settings at the minute.
So I tend not to confess to which buildings I actually worked on around the countryside.
Given the opportunity to say you didn't and you didn't take it, makes me think you have. So you've came back to farm then, Joe. When was that, sorry?
So came back to run the butchery side of life in 2007. So parents or dad and grandparents bought the farm in the mid-70s, and then mum and dad bought the butcher's business in the mid-80s. When it came to sort of 2007, mum hadn't been particularly well for a while, and she was primarily responsible for running the shop, and was just wanting to get out of that. So they were looking at selling it, at a time when it probably wasn't that sensible to sell. There wasn't an obvious buyer for it, and the plan was that I would come back try and make a go of it for 5 years, and then have a look at it, and put a certain amount of investment in it, take it on, and then if we all decided that we wanted to sell, then we'd do that, and that was fine. So yeah, no, that's when I came back to the butchery side of it.
So you came back the butchery side, and at that point, still no intention of the farm, is that right?
No, I mean the farm was dad's domain, that was his baby, and to be fair, there wasn't really room for me. There wasn't It was going to be very difficult to add in something which would justify my existence on the farm as it was without displacing something else. And I realized that, and frankly, I had my hands full with the butchery side of it.
So, funnily enough, the last person I filmed with, I don't know if you know Jack Young, their Overton farm.
Oh,
They kind of got a similar story, in fairness, actually. And the butchery side quite interested me because it's something I really don't know about. Could you tell us a bit about the, is it butchery? I take it's not abattoir, it's butchery solely, is that right?
It's just butchery only, and the reason it came about was When on the farm, when the farm was first bought and started out, Dad and Mum were very much into Highland cattle. They were quite well known in Highland cattle circles, and we were exporting genetics all around the world. But for every pedigree bull or pedigree heifer that you sell at half reasonable money, you end up with a heap of unfancied stirks and heifers, which don't have a value in the open market then or now. And the best way to do was to put it through a butcher shop and try and add value that way. So that's how that came about. And parents bought a high street butcher in Forres. And at the time, there was three other butchers in Forres. And primarily just retail trade off the street. And they quickly added a food service side to the business and then moved into mail order as well.
I guess this is a bit of an off the cuff question, but it's quite interesting to hear from yourself in this game. What had supermarkets done to the selling of meat from like a butchery perspective, and just in the UK in general? You know, is it? It's obviously they've taken a fair chunk away, but has it caused a problem or is it still workable?
So when we first had the butcher shop, we still didn't have, did we have a Tesco's in town by then? I'm not sure if we did or if we did, it has just come along. And a lot of supermarkets had a full-blown butcher's counter. So it, whilst it maybe took business away, it also made it people more comfortable with still buying meat over a counter. I think the real damage now is that people tend not to go into high street shops, so they go into supermarkets because it's convenient, and all they see is pre-packed food, pre-labeled, pre-priced, and that makes it more difficult for a consumer to go into a butcher's shop where it's maybe still trays of meat and trays of steaks and sausages, but they don't have that absolute knowledge of how much it's going to cost them, or am I going to look stupid asking for two sausages, for example? So, it takes away some of, supermarkets are easy. You just pick up a packet. If you like it, you put it in your basket, and if you don't, you don't, and you pay for it, and away you go. Whereas with in a butcher's shop, there is more of a there has to be more of an interaction so that people can walk away knowing that they've got what they want.
And how have you found there's more than just yourself, like you said when it started? Did you find you had to sort of quite ferociously market yourself, or was that quite easy enough to gain custom?
So, we're all doing different things
Yeah.
in the town. So we've all got different markets. We move a lot of product out with the local area, and somebody else is supplying supermarkets, and somebody else is concentrating in a retail trade. So, from that point of view, it's fine, and we all get on reasonably well with each other, so which helps. So no, it's I think. Where you're having to more ferociously market yourself is with other businesses that are doing a similar sort of thing to you. So other big mail order businesses, or even farm shops now are probably more of our competition than maybe a high street butcher.
So, you found yourself coming back, getting established in the butchery side. How long did it take? You're obviously involved in both now. How long did it take before you found yourself getting involved in the ground of the farm as well?
So it must have been about 7 years. Both my parents died in relatively quick succession. So Mum in 2014 and then Dad in 2015. And we suddenly found ourselves with a farm, which we hadn't really planned for. There was no succession plan in place. When Dad died, he was a sole trader. Which is a nightmare situation if you're in a family situation where that's a possibility. Have a look at it. No hurry. Anytime yesterday would have been fine. So we took on the farm in 2015. We moved up almost 8 years ago to the day. And suddenly we we'd sort of stumbled our way through that first winter, and it became apparent that we had a small farm, we had 30 cows and followers, we didn't have enough of a turnover to pay the bills, we didn't have enough money in the bank to pay the bills that had already been incurred by my father, and the bank accounts were frozen anyway. So even if we wanted to, we couldn't pay anybody.
Quite a nice start, that, isn't it? Quite
Yeah, it's lovely.
great.
It's lovely. There was a fairly serious loan, and yeah, it was a bit of a you did sit there wondering why on earth we ended up coming up to the farm. But so when we were sitting there going, well, what do we do with this? And it was a very difficult time to really get cracking with it.
I would just like to quickly interrupt the show for a minute to give you some extra information about our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, the new name for A Plan Rural. Howden Rural provide bespoke insurance cover for farms and estates. This could be for anything from tractors and machinery to a new exciting diversification venture. Be sure to check out Howden Rural today. Did you have obviously do well, the listeners don't know this, but just before we before we hit record, one of your kids was in. Did you have kids at that point?
So when we moved up to the farm, we had Ayla would have been around about 3, Tilly would have just been born, and yeah, Rory hadn't been thought of yet.
Yeah. Which adds to the trauma, jumping into
yeah,
something like that when there's two wee ones,
it's, I mean, in many ways, they were absolutely critical to us to surviving that, and I do see it as a period of survival, because it doesn't matter what is going on in the world around you, they don't know about it and they don't care. So all they want is fed, cleaned, a bit of attention every now and again, and so there are times when you just actually have to drop everything and concentrate solely on them, and that's actually quite cathartic. And yeah, it helped a lot. I mean, yeah, it's stressful. And you then add a third one into the mix, and it's another period of no sleep. But yeah.
On the we'll get into sort of, you mentioned numbers at the start when you took it over and stuff, but just in your background, a photo's caught my eye. What sort of weather do you get where you are? Is, I mean, the photo I'm talking about for those listening is, I think if my eyesight's good enough, a bunch of cattle. I'm guessing from the colours it's Highlanders, but I could be wrong. And a pretty snowy setting. Is that the case, or is that very rare?
I would say we're in as good an area as we possibly can be. We get a modest amount of rainfall a year. It's we don't tend to get really savage amounts. We don't get huge amounts of snow. December, January, February would be the times that we would normally get it. It's a good area to farm. From a weather point of view, we don't get West Coast levels of rain, and we don't get that savage easterly wind as well that you get on the East Coast, which just strips everything out. So yeah, no, we're in a good grass growing area.
So yeah, continue on with that joke. Tell us about the farm itself, from a ground perspective and what you have on it. I'm guessing things have changed since you took over, or maybe they're the same.
Yeah, so we own Eden Vale is just a small farm. It's about 100 acres here, and then we rent and have a small tenancy, which takes in about another 300 acres just locally. A lot of seasonal ground. We have Highland and Shorthorn cattle. We did have some Aberdeen Angus, but I'm trying to breed them out the system. And then we take everything through, or pretty much everything through to finishing for the butcher shop. We sell a few stores, we sell a few fat elsewhere. And yeah, everything is 100% grass and forage fed. So we've stripped out concentrate out the system. We've stripped out major inputs. And yeah, everything's all the beasts are moving every couple of days, and yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
Is the goal to have 100% of what's going off your farm going through your butcher shop, or are you happy where you are?
We have scope to take more through the butchery business, but the goal would be to have enough for the butchery business, enough for retaining heifers, and to be able to sell some surplus elsewhere. So it's to try and, yeah, we want to, ideally I'd like to be selling direct to other butchers, or direct into a fat ring. I prefer to work off private trade if I can, but just to have a wee bit of just to cover some bases, basically.
Do you show at all?
Not anymore.
Not
So when I
anymore.
grew up,
Okay.
we were pulled around every local and national show, showing Highlanders, and yeah, Dad would be putting in the hours, getting cattle ready for the shows. But no, it's not something I've got. It's that eye for detail thing again. It's just not, it doesn't interest me.
I'll be honest, there's nothing more I love than walking around your cattle lines in that at the Highland. And I don't just mean at 1 in the morning, I mean in general. But yeah, it must be a tough game doing that consistently. In every show, being there for 4 days when you might have 20 minutes in the ring, it's rough, it's intense.
It is, and I take my hat off to those that do it, and the passion that they should clearly have for it, I think, is just awesome. But for me as well, I'm looking at cattle in maybe a slightly different way to what most people would be looking at the Highland Show or anything else. I'm the cattle beast that you breed for the show ring is not the same as the cattle beast you breed for the butcher shop, in my opinion.
Okay, yeah.
So it's yeah, so I think that's part of the reason that it doesn't excite me in the same way, and it doesn't draw my interest. I mean, I love seeing them, and I love the, if I'm down at the Highland, I'll make a point of going to the Highland Ring, and I'll go down the cattle lines, but it's the actual show scene is not for me, and it's not part of where our business is at.
Do you have a set sort of Europe scale fat class that you're targeting consistently, or is it pretty open?
It's pretty open because thankfully the butcher's pretty tolerant of what the farmer puts into the butcher shop, because the farmer can bugger it up quite savagely sometimes. No, I mean, we're looking at a weight of minimum live weight of 500, maybe 480 in the smallest Highlanders. We're looking for half decent cover. But again, it goes back to how this all came about, is the sort of animals that we have don't necessarily fit nicely into a Europe grid or into an open market. So it's good as a guide, but the best thing that we can do to judge how we're getting on is by cutting it into a steak and eating it, and working out what we've got that way.
Yeah, determinants of meat are completely subjective. Do you like it? Does it feel nice to eat? That's what matters.
And we can get very hung up on Europe grids and what it does or doesn't deliver. But at the end of the day, once you've cut, I mean, certainly once you've turned it into a burger, and there's good burgers and there's bad burgers, but once you've turned it into a mince product, nobody cares what Europe grid it achieved. Steaks, I think the Europe grid maybe works slightly against a good quality steak.
Okay.
If you're looking for certainly a some R's can be pretty big, and if you're cutting an 8 ounce steak, it's pretty thin.
Yeah.
And you want to be at the lower end of an R, possibly an O, to get that really nice thick steak that you can cook nice and rare if that's what you want to do.
It kind of leads me on to my next question. I think I know the answer. You mentioned earlier sort of trying to breed away, or maybe already have from the Angus, which is, I think, probably quite commonly regarded as a very good meat product. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly public perception, or not public perception, farmer perception is the Highlanders probably the opposite. However, your focus is forage and grass. And is that the reason? Is that the reason for that change, or is there other reasons?
So the reason for moving away from the Aberdeen Angus is at some point in the past, we've introduced some genetics, which has what it meant was that breeding cows were big cows and they were bullying out our smaller Highland and Shorthorn cows out of feed. And, I haven't got the patience or the resources to manage them as a separate group. I don't want to be in that game. At the same time, I was looking at young stock that we were trying to finish. And at that time, we were still using barley, and you would be shoveling barley into them to try and fatten them up. And all they would do is just grow and grow and grow. And, they weren't fleshing up. So, for us, there's as much variance in breeds as there is between breeds themselves. So, I think I don't have anything against the Aberdeen Angus breed as such. It was the Aberdeen Angus that we had which were causing us problems. That said, we have moved to a complete grass and forage system, and that's been consumer driven. And the Highland and Shorthorn fits that system a lot better than some of the more commercially minded Aberdeen Angus breeds and some of the other breeds that are out there. I can stick a Highlander out in any weather during the winter, and it'll just look at the weather coming in and go, "Is that it? Is that all you've got?" And that's important.
Are any housed at any point?
So, for the last number of years, so cows are pretty much outwintered all the time. The only time they come in is to calve. And it's not because they couldn't calve outside, it's because, from a management point of view, we're stretched and it is just much easier to have them in inside. And then once they've calved, we boot them out. But if there's a problem, the next handling system, we can tag calves easily and safely. And it just makes life a lot easier. Young stock, for the last number of years, we've kept them out. I don't think we've got the management of that right, and we've maybe not done them many favors. So, calves this year, young stock will be in this year.
Yeah, that I in fairness, I maybe worded it wrong. I more meant your young stock. You mentioned earlier about weights, your sort of target weights. I don't think you said ages. Have you got a target age? Maybe you did, and I missed it though.
So the best of the Shorthorns will kill out at about 19, 20 months old, and we'll take them at about 600 kilos,
Right.
maybe 550, 600 kilos. They might be on the lean side. There might be threes rather than 4Ls, but we'll quite often need a Christmas kill. So, we need those beasties there. Most of them are going at 24 months. Which is fine, but it is a second winter, which is a bit more expensive. And then the pure Highlanders will go 36, 40
Oh,
months.
is it right? Okay.
Yeah, we have to look at them for an awful long time
Yeah.
before they're ready to go. And some will go quicker, but yeah, by and large, it can be that sort of timescale.
Three winters is costly.
3 winters is costly, and it's something that we're looking at. So the Highlander is really important to me as a good suckler cow. They are hardy, they're very low maintenance, very low cost, but we do have just too much Highland genetics in at the moment, just for that very reason that we're having to look at them for a long time. So we're changing the split. We were 50-50 Shorthorn to Highland. We're now going to be 2/3 Shorthorn to a third Highland.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And moving on a minute, Jock, to the reason we originally got in touch through Nuffield is you're obviously quite focused on nutrition from a breeding perspective. Are you? I don't want to guess, but are you sort of utilizing like EBVs at any point, or are you just looks good, or what's your sort of choice in that regard?
So we're relatively closed herd. So we're using EBVs on the bulls that we buy in. And then the cows, we're not using EBVs, but we it goes back to, you know, looking at what we're putting through the butcher's shop and what bloodlines are, you know, consistently providing good product to the shop, and then taking out what's not performing from that point of view. So it's that sort of performance that we're looking at, rather than out and out EBVs in the breeding program.
And yeah, as I said, the sort of reason we originally got in touch and organized this chat was Nuffield. And as I said at the start, it'd be quite interesting to hear Jock your opinion on, before we even talk about your topic, just Nuffield in general. It's, as I said, right as we kicked off, it's quite a surreal feeling. Are you still in that sort of type moment?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's I was going through papers on my desk the other day, and I found my letter halfway down a stack of papers, and I went, yeah, it's still real. It's just incredible. I mean, I think a good friend was talking about Nuffield to me probably as long ago as 5, 6 years ago, and I probably sat with an open application for 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
But it just with everything that was going on, there was too much transition here, and but it was getting to the point where, you know, you count down how many years you've got left to apply, and you're so young you don't even need to think about
I'm not that young. I'm
that.
not that young.
For us that are getting on a bit more, you know, I was I think, you know, I've got 3 years left to apply, and then it became this year it was two, and so yeah, it's you it then puts the pressure on somewhat.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, the pressure's on, you were successful. It's what matters.
Yeah, well, it's yeah, I was just it's just amazing. I mean, it's such you hear so much about it, and just what people do with it, and then what they go on to do afterwards. And you know, part of you wants to test yourself to see if you can raise your game to that level, because it is such a high level. And then when you get it, you just think, oh shit, well maybe I can get to that level. And then you have to prove that you can. And I guess that's the next stage. But yeah, just awesome.
It's funny because, like, the application process was, it sounds cocky, but I'm quite comfortable in an interview. If I get to that process, I'm fine. And if it doesn't work out, grand. But the application was the bit I must have written it 15 times. And I actually slightly changed, because originally I was looking at social media, and I've since written a draft proposal for a PhD on that. And I think it fits that more. And then education and this, I just feel like it works better. So I'd actually written about four examples of the social media one, and then probably three or four of this, you know. But it's just, it's something I'd been aware of since probably my mum and dad. I remember a guy, I think my mum must have went to college with him or something like that. He was on the telly talking. I think his name, I think now I say telly, his name was Paul Kelly, because I seem to remember them saying Paul Kelly on the telly. And he was an Nuffield scholar, and I was, as a kid, don't mean anything, but I remember mum and dad saying, like, oh, he's a Nuffield scholar. And that's sort of always been in my head, you know, and it's quite cool. But could you tell us, we spoke with David a wee bit about this, what was the process of Nuffield application, you know, to now, like, for you?
So what's it been like? I guess it's been quite long, because so I had an application in last year, and my topic last year was very much about a situation that I was in at the time and what I was really interested in at the time. Put a lot of work into it, and didn't get to interview. And at the time, I was absolutely gutted. And it took me a wee while just to get my head around that and get it straight. And there was sort of one or two other things that happened at the same time, which maybe didn't help. But looking back at it now, I'm really glad I didn't get it, because the topic was a there and then thing. And actually, since then, I've moved on from that, and
Right.
I've moved on my thinking. I've moved on my farm business, and there probably wasn't enough in it for a Nuffield scholarship. And even if there was, I don't think I'd articulated it enough. So I think so whilst it was a bit of a grueling process, I think when I had time to reflect on it and then went and sat down to reapply this year, I think I had a much stronger place as to where I wanted to be and where I wanted to get to and what I wanted to look at. And I actually didn't rewrite my application that many times this time round. So the first time round I did, I had loads of drafts of it. I think this time round I only had one or two drafts. And I think it was just a bit clearer and a bit more concise. And yeah, it seems to have resonated. It seems to have struck a chord, which is, you probably found it as well. The amount of goodwill and offers of help and support that received already is just, it's amazing. That I did not expect at all.
I think it's important to shout out Charlotte Merson. Like,
Yeah.
oh my God. How did she do so much? Charlotte, if you're listening, you've been an absolute godsend. You really have. I
It
really
must be like herding cats, that job.
Oh man. Because I'm not gonna lie, like I think I'm a pretty quite calm person, quite collected, don't get too stressed about stuff. But see all the emails that came after that successful application. My God, man, it's never ending. And I probably email Charlotte like 3 times a day sometimes, like, but I thought I did this. I thought I did this. I thought I did this. I'm going to try and show off, Jock, and please call me out if I do it wrong. I think I know what your title is. Is it Enhancing Meat Eating Quality from Completely Pasture, no, Pasture and Forage Based Beef? Nope, raised beef.
Yeah, you're pretty close. So,
Yeah,
yeah,
brilliant.
enhanced meat eating quality from 100% grass and forage fed beef.
That's close. That's
So,
close.
yeah, in a nutshell, you're absolutely right.
So tell us about that then. You maybe it'd be quite interesting to hear, if you're happy saying it, what your title was last year and what sort of made that change happen.
The title last year was it was all to do with resilience, both farm resilience and personal resilience.
Okay.
I can't remember the name of the title off the top of my head, but that was what it was about. And it was in the face of things like massively rising fertilizer prices, costs going through the roof. And I felt that a lot of businesses just weren't particularly resilient, and a lot of people weren't particularly resilient. And I put myself in that category. But it was the feedback that I got was that the topic had been done before. And I don't think I'd articulated it well enough as to what I was trying to achieve. The other thing that always nagged me about that topic was, I'm very privileged that I get to see the whole of the chain from, the birth of a calf right through to a steak on a plate. And I don't think I was really, that particular topic was looking at one aspect of the business, and I was missing the opportunity to potentially look at the whole thing. And so with the changes that we've made on farm, it ticks a lot of boxes for the consumer in a very positive way. But what I feel that we're impacting on slightly is a bit of the eating qualities that some people might be looking at, and namely that would be tenderness. We're hitting flavor quality markers, we're hitting some of the softer markers, like in terms of biodiversity gain, carbon emission reduction, and all those things. But the cost is coming at a tenderness sacrifice in the meat, which you really notice in the steaks. And I think that is because nutritionally we're not getting it right, certainly over the winter, and sometimes we're not getting it right during the real pinch periods, going from winter into spring and at the other end as well.
You might have slightly lost me there, maybe because I didn't quite pick you
Sorry,
up.
I was
Or,
rambling a bit.
no. I either didn't pick you up wrong or just went over my head. But what's the relationship between hitting sort of carbon sequestration, biodiversity targets and whatnot in exchange for a loss of tenderness? Is there a direct correlation there, or is that just a
The honest answer is I don't know.
right?
And that's part of what I want to look at. So, we're as a industry from the consumer point of view, and take away supermarkets and all of that jazz, what is the consumer looking for? And they're looking for a really tasty, tender bit of meat that they can eat without worrying if they're destroying the planet. And then it needs to be nutritionally dense as well, because there's no point in eating it and burning the calories if it's got absolutely no nutritional benefit to you whatsoever. Now, red meat is a very, as we all know, a vital part of a healthy diet. But are there certain regimes that can boost that nutritional density? And if there is, is there a knock-on effect on other traits? So, and it's maybe the way that we've done it, but we've concentrated on carbon emissions, on biodiversity, on taking out some of those concentrate feeds, which do provide a nutritional benefit, but what's the knock-on effect of that been?
That's interesting. That's good. It's been really interesting to speak to only three of you so far. And every single one that's been sort of explained, I'm like, like it. Me and Tab are probably disagreed on our opinions on her topic, but that doesn't mean I'm not interested in hearing what comes of it. Like I guess it's quite interesting to ask, before you've done anything yet with it, Jock, where do you think it's going to go? What do you think? Do you have an idea in mind as to what you think you're going to find?
I'm trying hard not to.
I'm doing the exact same. Yes.
I'm trying to approach this from a really open mind. For me, it's important to, some of the things, the place I want to go to, Japan, for example, to
Same.
look at Kobe beef production, which, is very high concentrates diet. You come up with this beautifully marbled beef. But, again, you can have the criticism that it looks brilliant, cooks really well, really tender, but doesn't actually taste it very much. So, all this nutrition that we put into an animal has an effect somewhere along the lines. And if we want to produce a really good product out of a certain feeding regime, what do we need to be doing to absolutely hit all those quality markers, and can we hit all those quality markers? And
Kobe,
if not,
sorry, on you go.
sorry, and if not, then what's the next best option?
They're all making me think.
I hope in a good way. I hope you're just not thinking, oh, he's on
Nah, man,
another
not at all.
planet.
Not a tear. I think, let's even forget my opinion. I'm very interested in it, but I don't think people get Nuffield scholarships on nonsense. I think it'd be fair to say. It's Kobe's not Wagyu. It's a different
So
something to do with Wagyu, isn't it?
it's different. So Wagyu is, oh, Kobe's breed as well, I think. But it's slightly different regime. Kobe is as well. I think it's like a PGI. So
Just googled it. That's exactly what it looks like. Yeah.
it's a PGI, and it's produced to a very certain standard in a very certain region of Japan.
Kobe beef is Wagyu beef from the Tajima strain of Japanese black cattle raised in Japan's Hyogo Prefecture, according to rules set out by Kobe Beef Marketing and Distribution Promotion Association.
There you go.
Yeah, so yes.
And part of this is to try and follow all these production systems right through to the end product, and trying to understand what's driving, really top chefs to buy that product. We're quite parochial in this country. It all has to be Scotch. It all has to be, or or British beef. You go to America, it's coming from New Zealand, Australia, Uruguay, Argentina, and people are selecting beef there like they're selecting wine. You know, we've got no problem drinking French wine or South African wine, but we seem to be really parochial about beef. Whereas in other countries, they're going, I want that beef because it's the best beef for what I want to do with it. So it's trying to understand those purchase drivers and the quality that they're looking for from certain production systems.
Forgetting sort of desire for quality of food on your plate when you consider buying, let's say, Argentinian beef versus Scottish beef. There's two schools of thought. There's the environmental school of thought, and then there's the trade school of thought. And I think in farming and maybe like quality assurance and whatnot, I'm very close with a lot of people in QMS. So don't think this is a slant against QMS at all, just using them as an example. They'll promote Scotch because it's better for the environment, whatever, and we push that better for the environment, and it's better for, it's arguably better in some ways for food security if we've got reduced food miles on a product and that sort of thing. But if we push that too far, trade disappears, and quote unquote developing, I hate the term, developing nations aren't going to have anyone to trade with. So you, if we've got to be conscious of that from a humanitarian welfare level as well. And I think you're right. I think I'm very much a promoter of Scotch, British, Irish, whatever. But at the same time, and look, we can't forget trade because they're in bother if we do that. You've been, sorry, Jock, on you go.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we can't, you know, Scotch in theory is a premium product. And you know, best will in the world, a premium product is not going to go into every eating establishment, or it's, you know, and we've got carcass balance to consider, and we've got seasonality to consider, especially when it comes to lamb. So, you know, we need this element of trade, and we need to be able to get the right product in the right place at the right time. And it's, I mean, I think Scotch is a brilliant brand. I think it's been hugely successful. And you know, we can gripe and groan about, you know, things around the periphery of it, but you know, by and large, it's been a brilliant thing for our industry. But it maybe needs sort of stratified a bit now to for it to get into different marketplaces domestically and around the world.
And I think you make a good point with that. Earlier you said about what are the top chefs doing. Top chefs are a very small percentage of what meat's going out there. You know, we've got to consider what's going into everyone's kitchen 7 days a week. And one thing that I've caused some divide, shall we say, is I think farmers are bad at saying, oh, well, you have to pay for quality. Very few people can. We're in a position that, especially at the minute, where even in one of the arguably most developed countries on the planet, in the UK, a lot of people are struggling to afford food. And the last thing they care about is the quality of their meat. They care about the energy and protein in it. That's what matters. You know, and it's something we've got to be mindful of as well. You mentioned, Jock, you mentioned Japan. Where else are you planning? What is your Nuffield plan, I guess?
We've got the CSC in Brazil, and then I'm gonna head over the border to Uruguay, after that, and then come back home, and then looking at Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. And one of the reasons I want to go to Australia is they've got the best grading system in the world, arguably,
Okay.
MSA. And whilst I don't want to look at grading systems, I do want to see how that grading system influences on farm decisions as to how they feed and breed animals. And then also head into America and Canada.
One, two. When is that? One,
Quite a lot.
seven. Yeah. No, very good.
I hadn't had Uruguay on the list until I went to until I had my mock interview. Alex Brewster, who was helping out at that, he suggested Uruguay, and I had a quick look at it. Yeah, how did I miss that one?
Well, you're there as well. Like we're in, well, we're
Yeah.
not. Brazil's massive, but you're a hop away in global terms, you know.
Yeah.
And in
Yeah,
fairness, we're in
the jet
Brazil
lag's
are pretty close.
not so bad if you just hop me across the border.
I hope you've kicked your feet up and got comfy and enjoying another fantastic episode of the R2 Cast with another really interesting guest. I would just like to quickly take another second to plug the sponsors of the show today, the Scottish Farmer. And I would strongly advise you to go out and pick one up this week and see even more of the fantastic people that are in our industry.
I'm looking forward to Brazil.
Yeah. Are
Yeah,
you
man.
doing any of the tours afterwards?
Already really pushing the limits with holidays at this point. Yeah. Right, so I'm just back from Ukraine last week. I'm going to States on Saturday. And then go to Shetland at the end of the week after that. I've got 3 days for Nuffield, I think, the week for Parliament, a week for Brazil. And then Nuffield starts. So yeah, we're it's funny because I went to and I also missed a week at the start of this year because I was in Rwanda. So I went to Tanzania and Rwanda in August. And
Fantastic.
yeah, I the start of August, I'd been to Holland and Iceland. And by November, I've added one, two, three, four, five, six countries to that. And I think I've
Awesome.
finished all the continents by this time next year. So it's been a bit mad, but yeah, that sounds
That's
brilliant.
fantastic.
It's MSA, Meat Standards, something that's
Meat Standards Australia.
yeah.
And the it's done on algorithms, it's been done on extensive consumer testing. I think I've been sent some stuff from Wales actually, where they've been looking at something similar, I think, as well. And yeah, so it's yeah, there's a lot of call in the industry for a new grading system in the UK to get us away from Europe grids. I don't think it's ever going to happen. I think there could be add-ons. I think that's being talked about at QMS a wee bit, but it's we've got to, my feeling is that we've actually got to move away from trying to change grading systems and actually look at production systems and link that through to consumer testings and do it that way. It'd be easier if we had a grading system, but I just don't see the political appetite for it.
Well, Europe's obviously a five-part grade. For those listening, I'm not an idiot. It's not Europe like the continent. It's Europe like the continent
All the
without
band.
E. I know how many letters there is. It's EUROP. America's sorry, Australia's is nine. Is that right? Is it one through nine? Or zero through nine, which is ten. Zero through
Depends
nine,
what you're looking
actually.
at, but I think they do it slightly differently so that you put in carcass traits, cattle traits into this algorithm, and it will spit out sort of one star, two star, three star for a particular cut of meat, depending on how you cook it.
Got you.
But it's a really powerful system. So in theory, what it enables you to do is extract maximum value from a carcass, whilst at the same time ensuring eating quality for a particular cooking method.
That particular cooking method's so important.
Oh, absolutely.
Not even
It's
considered.
key.
Not even considered, you know.
And that's one thing that slightly bothers me about all this. You go and do all this work as to producing, the best bit of beef you can, and then somebody goes and destroys it on a frying pan at home. But you've got to have a bit of faith in them, I guess.
Well, that's you do have to leave it. You do have to leave it. No, I hear it sounds like a really good one, Joe. Sounds like a really good and worthwhile project. Have you
Yeah, I'm
sort of
looking forward
been
to it. It certainly seems to, as I say, it seems to have struck a chord with people, and it's yeah, just amazing how many people have come forward with, suggestions, places to go, offers of help, and yeah, for anybody listening, I'm open to more. It's I think probably be the same for all of us if anybody's got any thoughts or ideas to ping them over.
It's been amazing in that sense, in fairness. Yeah, it really has been. Whether it's offers of financial support or offers of just general assistance, contact assistance, whatever. Is it RAS that's supporting you? Is that
Yeah, so supported by RAS and the Worshipful Company of Butchers.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, lucky got two sponsors in my corner, so that's brilliant.
Fantastic, fantastic. No, it sounds
I
good.
don't know if it means I get double the money to go traveling with,
I
but
don't think it does, Jock,
no.
unfortunately. It does. It sounds really good. And having to, but I don't know much about the worshipful company of butchers. But I did speak to the guy who was there with worshipful company of farmers. It sounds like quite an interesting thing. So yeah, no, very good, very good. Yeah, look forward to following the travels. Look forward to seeing where you go and see where you end up. And Uruguay is an interesting one. The Uruguayan, am I right in saying the Uruguay? Well, am I mixing up countries here? Uruguay was Pinochet in the 80s, wasn't he? And he was pretty bad, or the 60s, I think, their president. And then at the minute, I believe their president is, he's about 80 years old, and he's on a salary of about £15,000. I think.
I haven't looked into too much into the
Yeah.
political side of it. I've been sort of looking at farms. I mean, it's an amazing grass growing area.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
you know, very small country exporting small amounts of beef, but you know, sitting next door to Brazil and Argentina, which are just overwhelmed with cattle numbers, and realizing that they can't compete in the commodity market. So are aiming for quality markets and exporting around the world, hold Scotch up as the pinnacle to which they're aiming for,
Oh, really?
by all accounts. So and just yeah, just seem to be very much that way geared. So yeah, really looking forward to getting stuck into there. I've got some interesting places to tap up to see if I can go and speak to them and see them.
Brilliant. No, I look forward to following it, Joe. Really do. And with a capital city loosely translating to mountain video, what more could you want? I've got such a weird, pointless political geographical knowledge. Capital cities, flags, all that sort of stuff.
But how,
Nothing.
what's the tallest mountain in the UK, Wallace?
Well, I think it's quite near me, is it not?
I seem to think I heard you struggling with that the other day, and maybe mentioned a wee peak in Wales somewhere.
Did I say it was Snowdon? Yeah, well, this is the
Yes.
trouble with having released about 11,000 minutes of you speaking. You do say the wrong thing from time to time. Ben Nevis, Jock, thank you. Who did I say that to? Because I actually
The
remember saying that now, but I can't remember who I said it to. You remember?
yeah, it was on the Claire Whittle podcast.
That's right. So it was. That's right. Well, the capital of Uruguay actually is Montevideo. So.
Yeah, good knowledge.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. No, good stuff, man. And here, it's been a pleasure to talk, and I'm sure we'll speak for a hell of a lot longer when we do meet in a couple of weeks' time, or 3 weeks' time, I should say.
Yeah, no, looking forward to that and looking forward to meeting you in the flesh and everyone else, actually.
Yeah, it's gonna be good. It's gonna be good crack. I'm feeling good. Another thing I was a bit confused about. I signed up for that Darts Farm tour, and Charlotte messaged me this morning. She's like, "Yeah, you're not gonna manage that." And I was like, "I'm so confused. I'm so
No.
confused. Just put me down for what you want."
Just tell me where I need to be and when.
For sure, for sure. But before I let anyone go, Jock, there's two questions I ask everyone. One of them I'm not a fan of, I'll be honest, but I still force the guests to answer it, and that is, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And the second one is, if you had tips for folk going into farming, what would they be?
Wow, okay. So I'm going to give you 5 and 10 years then.
Ooh.
Yeah, so in 5 years' time, producing awesome tasting beef that hits a multitude of quality markers, in environmentally and taste and tenderness and all of that, and hopefully helping other people to do the same. That's like to be doing that. 10 years' time, our kids, eldest kid will be 21, youngest
How's
will be
that feel?
six.
How's that
Brilliant, brilliant. Soon be able to retire, hopefully. Get them through college or university if that's what they want, and then sail off into the sunset. No, but we'll have an idea then if they want to come into the business or not. And if they do, That would be brilliant. If they don't, that'd be cool too. And but in 10 years' time, hopefully bringing on the next generation, whether related to us or not, and going into more of a guiding and mentoring role and helping out whilst hopefully still fit and able, with an exit plan so that Fiona and I can retire sometime further down the line. So that's sort of where we're at with that.
And on that, is it looking like the three? Obviously, they're all quite young, I know, but anyone got an interest in the farm?
Yes and no. They go through geese. I wasn't encouraged to come back to the farm. It wasn't an option. I would love to think that we're encouraging our kids to have a look at it as an option and creating the space for them. That doesn't mean I want to hand everything on a plate to them. I think that they've still got to come on with their own ideas and thoughts as to how they're going to develop the business. But I do want to be able to grow a business so that there's at least the possibility of all three of them coming back in if that's what they want to do. I'd almost rather sell everything up than say, well, you can come in, but you two can't.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm with
I'd
you.
rather not create that potential for division. So that's where we're at. I think two potentially might be thinking about it at a very early stage. One, I think, is going to live in a fairy world somewhere, and it sounds like a very nice place to be. And she might be the one that surprises us and says, "No, I'm gonna have a go at this." But I would hope that we're not forcing them one way or another.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty positive way to look at it.
Yeah,
And
I hope so.
if you had tips for folk, any advice for people coming into farming, what would they be?
Oh, hustle. It's a really difficult industry to break into. As I have two parts to this, I think those that are wanting to come into the industry, I think it is difficult. I was very lucky, and I recognize that I'm lucky in that we've inherited this place, maybe not under ideal circumstances. But I think there's a lot of people that would, bite the hand off to have the opportunity that we've got here. Whatever I say, it's in that context. But I think the opportunities will always come along, but you need to be in a position to try and take advantage of them, and that means probably working in the industry. And working with people, trying to learn all the time and show an aptitude, and then hopefully those opportunities will present themselves. But equally, as business owners, as employers, as people maybe further up the chain, if you like, we have to be much, much better at presenting those opportunities. Now, whether that's share farming or whatever it might be, I think when we recognize good talent, we have to be much better at trying to retain that and getting them into more integral parts of the business, and businesses, and allowing them to let rip a bit more rather than trying to control people.
I agree. Yeah, I really do. I think there's a lot of that in fairness. Yeah, no, would agree. Good points, I would say, to end on. Good points to end on there. And I hope the whole chat for yourself, Chalk's been quite nice. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been good. It's been good to be able to talk about all this, actually.
Yeah.
It's we all live in sort of splendid isolation quite often, and there's a limit to how many people want to listen to you drone on.
Well, here, I don't know why people listen to me. It must be the folk that I bring on. It's certainly not me they want to listen to 3 hours a week, that's for sure. No, thank you. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it. And for those of you listening, I hope you've enjoyed another good episode of the R2 Cast there. That's been number three of what will be 23, well, 22 guests on, speaking about their Nuffield scholarship, and maybe we'll get Ed to film with myself if yous want, which it does seem like yous do. The last episode we had was David Taverner, who is another Nuffield scholar this year, speaking about his Nuffield scholarship, which is aimed around insects as a livestock feed. So an interesting one there. A lot of questions about BSE was sort of my question line. Well, is that possible? Are they vertebrae? Surely they can't be, all this sort of stuff. So that was quite interesting. And then we're going on to Hugh Evans, who I think would go on pretty well with David. They're quite an interesting pair, in fairness, speaking about his farm, Three Pools Permaculture is what it's called. So quite an interesting Instagram there. If you do you do any social media you want to put out, Jock, or are you not overly?
Yeah, no, we're on Twitter at Edenvale Farm and Macbeth's, so two Twitter accounts there, and roughly the same for Instagram and Facebook. So yeah, do link up that way. It'd be great to have a few more followers
Yeah, it's always
rather
good.
than
It's
the
always
two
good.
that suffer us already.
So go check them out there. And as always, thank you for coming along. And we'll see you for R2Cast number 153. See you then.
I hope you've enjoyed another excellent episode of the R2 Cast as much as I have, and I would just like to quickly thank our primary sponsors of the show today, Howden Rural, the new name for A-Plan Rural. If you follow Howden Rural on social media, you'll see the plethora of work that they do to support this sector, and it's been a pleasure to work alongside them so far, and long may it continue. For more information about them, be sure to check out howdeninsurance.co.uk/rural, and I'll see you for the next episode.